everyone. Welcome to the members only Rest is History special. And this week, it's all about Dominic.
It's not really a special, though, is it, Tom? I mean, they're all special.
It's a special weekly. Every special is special. Okay. That's the thing. And on the topic of special, the special one, Dominic, before we started doing this, you've been hassling me about all kinds of things that make you look great.
No, so, that's absolutely
No, absolutely not. So honestly, we got the list of stuff from Sam, and I thought, yeah, that all looks fine. Although there is the opening thing does name check Dominic in a kind of very flattering way, but we'll come to that in a minute. But Dominic also then sent me an email saying, I think we should talk about how the Daily Mail described you when you wrote an article about how we're all going to get nuked. And the blurb on this was astonishing words from a historian as respected and sober as Dominic Sambrook. And ladies and gentlemen, Dominic sent me that. He's now emailed me about it. Clearly, nothing that's ever been said about him has ever tickled him quite so.
Made me laugh as much. Somebody once said to me, one of the tricks that the paper has is it never assumes, it acts always as though nobody ever has read you before or knows who you are. So you could have been writing for them for 50 years and it would still feel the need to introduce you in the kind of subheading. So nobody who has read my work over the last 10 or 12 years would think I was respected and sober. I would imagine.
Oh, this humble bragging, this false respected, sober.
I don't think sober. I don't think sober is. Because the rest of the headline is
you are by the standard of other male correspondents, and I'm thinking of that Mad Hitchens bloke. He's you are quite sober.
Very different.
Is it? Beast. Well, it's still the Daily. It's still the Mail, isn't it?
I suppose it's the same group.
So yeah. Dominic, do you see yourself as sober?
I don't think measured,
balanced.
Is what that publication calls for. I think. You know,
but you were saying you have no idea if the world is going to get blown up in a nuclear holocaust or not.
Yeah, but it might. It's fun to speculate about whether it will. I think that's the thinking.
In the same way, Dominic, that you once speculated in an article that if Jeremy Corbyn became prime minister, he might import the body of Chairman Mao to Downing Street and bring it back to life.
Bring it back to life, yes.
Was that similarly here? A sober speculation.
I once wrote a very respected and sober article about, it was about the German popularity of German cars. And it was the headline was Germany finally invades Britain. And the headline was a picture of Angela Merkel's head with one of the sort of Prussian helmets. Yeah, superimposed on it, the photo next to the headline.
Okay, so I think that answers the question as to whether you really are respected.
I think that's both respected and sober, to be fair.
Okay, so there's that. So we've talked about how respected and sober you are, but then there is this is the question that Sam wanted us to open with, and it's from Seb Banwell. Okay, serious question, Discord. Am I allowed to quote D.C. Sandbrook in my somewhat important history dissertation? How does one reference a podcast entitled World Cup of PMs discussing Palmerston as the aged but swashbuckling exponent of gunboat diplomacy? Thoughts?
I think you can. I don't know. Can you footnote a podcast?
We could name check him mentioned by the respected and sober historian.
Yes, I think
Dominic Sambrook.
The level of respect and sobriety surely means you can do it. I don't know. I think it very much depends on who's going to be marking it, Seb, is my answer to that, because the wrong marker, I mean, this might be the case with you as well, Tom, that the wrong academic sitting in judgment might see the words Tom Holland in the footnotes and say, oh, dear.
That is a topic that we may come to shortly in this episode. But yes, I imagine that lots of academics are big fans of your journalism in the Daily Mail.
They absolutely love it, yeah. When I first started writing for the Daily Mail, a colleague of my wife's said to her, he said, a terrible thing happened at the weekend. I took my son to have his hair cut, and the only newspaper they had in the barbers was the Daily Mail. And obviously I never would look at it normally, but I was just flicking through it, and your husband was in there. And she sort of made noises, apparently.
Did she pretend it was some other person called Dominic Sambrook?
She said it was an accident or something. It happened by mistake.
He got kidnapped at gunpoint.
Yeah, precisely. precisely. She needed a new fridge or some kind of, she had some kind of...
I mean, Dominic, on a serious point.
Yeah.
I mean, the Daily Mail is probably most academics' least favourite publication.
Daily Express, Star, they're not big enough, are they?
No, Daily Mail is, because it has, it's seen as having a bigger impact. So do you think it's impacted on your status as a respected and sober historian?
Yes, I think it would be impossible to say, to answer that and to say, I mean, it'd be mad to say no, because it's often the first thing that people mention.
Well, thank God for the podcast.
Yeah, well.
Where you can display your Marxism.
Exactly. Yeah, no, it's in a good way. So the good way is obviously lots of people, several million people have read my stuff who wouldn't otherwise read it, which is very nice. The downside is that there's a sort of, I don't know, 5,000 people.
Yes, who will never forgive you for it.
Yeah, who are beside themselves with rage. But I can probably live with that, to be honest with you.
I've written for the Daily Mail once, and I remember the blowback I got from that.
Did you? From people you knew?
No, people I didn't know. Distinguished historians of early medieval Europe.
Really?
Harumphing about it.
What did you write? Dom, the producer, wants to know what
It was about the rise of Islam.
But the thing that's very satisfying, Tom, is when I then get emails from academics saying, could I not tell anybody, but could they also put me in touch with the features editor? Because that's a really good idea for...
there was Mehdi Hassan, wasn't there, who was the political editor of the New Statesman.
So, as he was then,
working with Jason Cowley, of course, friend of the show. And didn't he go on Question Time or something and have a massive harumph about the Daily Mail? And
he
then
did.
The Daily Mail released the begging letters in which he'd asked to come and write for them.
Exactly. That's absolutely right.
That's actually how the media works in this country.
I sometimes get emails from academics informing on their own institutions with sort of, with attachments that say on them, strictly confidential.
Have a go at this.
And saying, please, can you expose my institution?
It's interesting. I write very promiscuously for a broad range of publications, including, of course, UNHERD Unheard. But I always get, most people don't care, but I find that it's always the right-wing publications that people complain about, never the left-wing ones.
Complain about as in they hold...
Yeah, they kind of say, why are you writing for them? Why are you writing for these fascists? All that kind of stuff. But I never get kind of, why are you writing for these Marxists?
I once was at a dinner at All Souls in Oxford.
Very impressive.
And I was introduced to this, it was incredibly boring, and I was introduced to this incredibly worthy man who I think was a musicologist or something like that. And he said, he looked at me and he said, I vaguely know your name. Why would I know your name? And I said, I've been on TV. He said, I don't have a television. And so we sort of went back, and then I said, well, obviously he didn't have a television. He was a fellow of All Souls. And I said, I sometimes write for newspapers. And he said, oh, which ones? And obviously I said, because I was at All Souls, I said, the Sunday Times. And he said, his face kind of, he winced and he took a backward step and he said, not my kind of paper at all, I'm afraid. And I said, gosh, that really is a different, world, isn't it? And I thought at the time,
if you'd said the Daily Mail, he'd have had a heart attack.
Yeah, exactly.
All of which is by way of what answer would you suggest to Seb? I think The Rest Is History is a very distinguished podcast. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because the joke about you being a Marxist. Mm-hmm. I mean, to a degree, you are. That is, your books. Do have a? You're very keen on the idea that.
Well, I think that's very loose. Real Marxists get very, and in fact, they harangued me on Twitter about it.
Yes, Alexei Sale did as well, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
but there is a kind of a certain materialist element to your analysis
yes.
of the sweep
I think
of
that's
events.
Absolutely right.
And you emphasise broad social trends over, say, individuals.
Yeah, I think that's true. But also, I'm not actually terribly interested in the history of ideas, which obviously I don't want to get back into the anti-science rant again. But I'm much more of a materialist than I am I don't believe the French Revolution was caused by Enlightenment values so much as expensive bread.
Yes, which is where we differ, I think. Right. I mean, I also believe in that expensive bread didn't help, but I do think that that obviously, I mean, obviously, I've written a whole book on how I think ideas change things. So, anyway, we're slightly floundering here, and we haven't even got beyond the first question. But I think you could say the rest is history. I think that's fine.
Okay, fine. That's fine. So the next question, which you're very keen on, you really want to do, don't you? It's from Tim Vasby Burney, top vicar, as he revels in that title. So I don't see any. I would be churlish to deny it.
He's like the all the medieval guys proclaiming themselves pope.
Right. Is he a pope in Avignon? Is he a top vicar of Avignon rather than in Rome?
I think he's the Church of England equivalent of an Avignon pope.
But he's in Shrewsbury, isn't he?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So he says. He's very excited because he saw that the Dwarf Flonking was happening this year, the Dwarf Flonking tournament or whatever was taking place. And then Lertz, 3019, actually advertised the fact that he was going to the Norfolk versus Suffolk Dwarf Flonking tomorrow. Hopefully I won't swap.
Okay, so Dominic.
Yeah.
I imagine that most people listening to this will know what Dwarf Flonking is. But just in case they don't, I think that... Dom, I know that you've got this lined up. Could we just have the sequence where, Dominic, you explain, and this was in the Olympics episode, wasn't it?
Yeah.
What Dwarf Flonking is. Maybe we could all just have a listen to it.
Are you an aficionado of Dwarf Flonking, Tom?
We talk of little else in the Holland household. So, of course, I'm a great fan, but just remind me what it is.
Do you want me to remind you of the rules?
Yes.
I'll remind you of the rules. So a dull-witted person is chosen as the referee, or jobbernowl. The two teams decide who will flonk first by tossing a sugar beet.
What is flonking?
Well, I'm going to explain. The game begins when the jobbernowl shouts, "Here you go together." The non-flonking team join hands and dance in a circle around a member of the flonking team, a practice known as girting. The flonker dips his dwile-tipped driveler into a bucket of beer, then spins around in the opposite direction to the girters and flonks his dwile at them. If the dwile misses completely, it is known as a swodge.
What else would it be called?
When this happens, the flonker must drink the contents
control yourself.
The flonker must drink the contents of an of an ale-filled gazunder before the wet dwile has passed from hand to hand along the lines of now non-girting girters chanting the ceremonial mantra of pot, pot, pot. So that's dwile flonking, and I believe it was invented actually in East Anglia and has since moved to the Cotswold Olympics and the Cotswold Olympics.
So why is that not on Sky Sport?
Sober and respected.
Yes. Yeah.
Very sober and respected. Very exciting to know that that people on this club have actually been going and doing that.
But Lertz, actually, it didn't go well. So he's written, unfortunately, I swodged twice and let the wangs down.
I don't think he did. I don't think he did. I think by taking part, he did the wangs proud.
Yeah, I think that's right, actually.
I mean, because we've never done it, so we don't know how difficult or easy it is to swodge.
I'll be frank with you, Tom, I don't think I'm ever going to do it. I look at the outfit that he was given.
I rather like it.
Uniform. It's very Morris dance, isn't it?
Yeah, which is
a practice that I approve of other people doing, but wouldn't do myself.
There's a photo of him and his trousers seem to be slipping down.
Possibly. Yeah, I think
maybe that's part of the traditional. I don't know. Anyway, so I think that's heroic, and I absolutely salute Lertz 3019.
Now, you and your brother, obviously your brother made a cameo appearance last week, talking about Operation Barbarossa. Tim G wants to know which brothers from history you're most like. He's given us various options: Agamemnon and Menelaus, Romulus and Remus, JFK and Bobby Kennedy, David and Ed Miliband. I don't think that's one you'd necessarily embrace. Perhaps Gary and Phil Neville. Again, probably not. What would you say, Tom? I mean,
somebody suggested Noel and Liam Gallagher, but that's not true because we get on very, very well.
Right.
I suggested Prince William and Prince Harry.
That's. I thought you got on quite well with your brother.
Yeah, we do. This is before we've had the bust up.
Right. Yes.
Because I'm kind of very, very tall, sober.
Yeah.
You know, responsible.
You support Aston Villa.
Support Aston Villa. And my brother's very keen on the army and the military.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I have to say that Rachel, his wife, is not...
Like Meghan.
She's not entirely like Meghan. I mean...
Not entirely.
I can think of no way in which she's like Meghan, apart from the fact that they're both women.
Right. Well, there's been a lot of chat about you, Tom, on the Discord. So
good. I've actually been away this week, so I haven't been keeping abreast of it. But
they had a big poll. What does Tom Holland hate most? It was after I'd said how much I hated science and so on. By far the biggest answer, 59%, nothing. Tom is pure love.
I think that's true.
That's your Christianity.
You know that. You know that I'm just love.
Well, I mean...
you know, I'm unfailingly nice about everyone, aren't I, Dominic?
You are. Well, yes. So we were seeing friends at the weekend, and who are journalists, and our hostess is a big fan of The Rest Is History, and she actually told me off for being too hard on you.
Really? What were you saying? What were you saying?
No, being hard on you in the podcasts.
Oh, I see.
I wasn't hard on you. I'm not hard on you behind your back.
You're bitching about me behind my back.
No, I wasn't.
Dominic, I forgive you because I am love.
She said you're very hard on Tom. But I pointed out to her that when we did a films thing at Podicon at Leicester Square, I said to your daughter, am I sometimes too hard on your dad in the podcast? And she said, oh, no, God, no. Give him more. You know, brilliant.
That's my girl.
But talking of being hard on you, Tom.
No, but hold on. There are other things that I hate. Stonehenge Tunnel. Actually, Stonehenge Tunnel's listed twice. American cultural imperialism. Yeah, that's probably true.
Oh, I might have misread this. Actually, have I misread this? And actually, what you hate is Spider-Man. These polls are very poorly constructed. I'm not slagging off the people doing the polls.
Yeah, actually, I think it is Spider-Man.
But they're using two colours that are the same. This is, sorry, for people who aren't seeing this.
Yeah, it is. Anyway, so among the list, Stonehenge Tunnel, yes, I don't like Stonehenge Tunnel. American cultural imperialism, yes, I'm cross about that. People who are mean to hedgehogs, definitely don't like them. Spider-Man, I don't mind Spider-Man. I accept the coincidence of the bloke who plays Spider-Man. It's a cruel one, but, you know, that's fate.
But then, Tom, very bad news for you. They had a poll about the best impression. Seen this? I'm not even sure you came in the top. Oh, no, you came third. You came third on your own podcast.
There is another comment on impressions from Ariana Reeds.
Right.
Who is an excellent person. Just out of interest, what's the historical impression that sticks with you the most from the pod? For me, it's a tie between Tom's Princes in the Tower and his John Wayne. I mean, they're both excellent impressions, and they're very, very good choices.
They are, Tom, but they're not what the public voted for.
So what the public have voted for is you as Churchill.
Yeah, followed by
you as Margaret Thatcher, and they are both easy. So this is like those equivalent of polls that they have. You know, what's the greatest album? And it will always be the one that people have been listening to most recently.
Or Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts.
Yeah, so I'm the Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band that just keep, you know, it's pure quality and people go for that no matter what. Whereas you are, you know, you're the kind of the listener's choice on the BAFTAs or something.
And the Daily Mail of podcasts.
You are the Daily Mail
and of podcasts. And you're the Guardian.
Yes, I think that's true.
It. That's how it is.
Or maybe the London Review of Books or something, or the TLS.
Well, unreadable.
No.
Dry.
Full of fascinating detail, thought-provoking.
Irrelevant to the book in hand.
No, I Ariana Reeds, Tom's Princes in the Tower. Because Winston Churchill, everyone can do that. Mrs. Thatcher, everyone can do that. But a Neanderthal.
You know what? I don't think Neanderthal is you at your best. I think your John Wayne is more remarkable, certainly.
Thank you.
And your King of Elam.
Yes. Yeah, well, we'll come to that later when we get to Babylon.
Well, I think we should now talk, because I think people have paid good money to be members of the Rest Is History Club for
maybe to hear our historical views.
Yeah, for less self-indulgent and more relevant, more historically relevant discussions. So let us talk, Tom, about the origins of Babylon.
Yeah.
So Tim Vansby Burney, I think, before I read out his comments, I think he correctly identified on the Discord the fact that this was a massive act of sleight of hand. We were pretending we had recorded it later because the first one had been such a success. But actually, we had recorded them the other way around.
Yeah, we had.
Because when I actually listened to it back, there were a couple of things where you said,
And we'll be coming to that later.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So anyway,
but you know who's to blame for that is Jack.
It is Jack's fault.
Which is, yeah. He's not here, is he? He's not here.
Basically all the producers.
He knows that.
They've come out of this story very badly. So anyway, Tim Vasby-Burney really enjoyed it. He said it was excellent. He really enjoyed the big gaps in history.
Well, it's very Vicar-tastic, isn't it? I mean, there were lots of kind of, you know, Assyrians and so on.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously the statue of Marduk traveling back and forth.
Yes.
But also he makes this point, and I think it is a fascinating point, actually, and worthy of greater discussion about historical time. So, you know, this thing we had in that podcast, sort of 300 years passed and nothing happened.
Yeah, he's talking about, so he says, whether it was 400 years of a particular empire, the Hittites can't remember, or six dynasties in which nothing really happened. Obviously, a lot did happen. I think that was the Kassites.
Yeah.
Who?
So he says, you know, changes that take place several generations ago become entirely normalized. Well, I think they do become normalized. I don't even think it takes 350 years, as he says, for an empire to take over. I mean, clearly for the people, you know, if you're the sort of sixth generation in the middle of that, you don't think of yourselves, I think, as living under occupation or...
No, and as we said, Babylon seemed to have a kind of remarkable ability to absorb its conquerors.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's a very, I mean, we just don't know. That's the thing.
So Stephen Clark... very much a friend of the show, a great sort of proselytizer on our behalf on social media, and a history teacher. He loved that episode. Well, he compared you to David Gower batting in his prime.
Ease and fluency, yeah.
His only criticism was it was all going to be a bit serious, and then came your impersonation of the King of Elam. So the King of Elam had lockjaw. That's correct, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
And
would you like to hear?
I'd love to hear it again, actually.
Okay, so shall I do the King of Elam reading out this sure. message from Stephen Clark?
Yeah. Brilliant.
So there it is.
That was very... Thank you. When we started this podcast, which is what, 2 years ago? Less than two years ago.
It never entered
my head for a moment. Remember when you were telling me about it on the phone?
Yeah.
And all the potential subjects we could do.
After I'd nicked Jack's croissant. Although I don't remember that at all. I think Jack made that up.
It never occurred to me that it would take this turn. So we did what else did we do last week? So we did Babylon. And we must have done something else on Thursday.
We did Barbarossa.
Barbarossa.
So should we come to that now?
Yeah, let's do the questions about Barbarossa.
So Sam the Belgian Wang, we can add another one to the list of Dominic's dislikes, food in Paris, science, and now also lengthy discussions on trucks.
Well, listen, I could talk about this for some considerable time. Now, I know we have a lot of crossovers with the We Have Ways podcast, so in no way do I wish to disparage We Have Ways, but I will say... the mechanics of military history are not really what get my juices flowing.
But had I not, before we did it, mentioned to my brother, please don't major on anything to do with trucks or tank treads or anything like that.
Yeah.
And so he did apologize whenever he mentioned trucks. But you see, I thought the stuff about trucks was really fascinating. You didn't have to go into all the stuff about the widgets or whatever. But the fact that all the trucks came from different, you know, there was no standardized, I thought was really interesting, and I hadn't realized that.
Well, it is. It is interesting, I think, if it's explaining something. I think when it's just intrinsically, I don't find the trucks interesting. I think they're interesting if they explain something, which obviously they did in Barbarossa. And there's actually a really good example of that at the moment in Ukraine. Because obviously, remember, there was that 50 or 40 mile traffic jam or whatever.
And stuck on the road and they couldn't go off piste.
And there were all these threads on Twitter with sort of experts in Russian trucks explaining what had gone wrong.
This was their hour.
They'd brought the wrong tires and all this sort of stuff. And that was kind of interesting in a short burst.
Which is, I think, what we provided in that episode was we provided a short burst of historically relevant
petrol caps
and fuel gauges and all that kind of stuff. And I think it was absolutely fascinating.
And would you know, Tom, Barbarossa is our best ever performing episode on the day of release, says Dom in the chat. So, what does that tell you? People like trucks.
People do like trucks. Well, I don't like trucks. I find them boring. I find everything to do with cars boring. I don't understand them. I have no idea how they work, and I don't really want to know. because I'm not interested. So a bit like you in science.
That's exactly the same as me. But
I did, when I talked to my brother about it, which is what gave me the idea for, that we should do this as a kind of Ukraine slanted episode. Mm-hmm. I did think that all the stuff he was saying about how the German high command hadn't realized that there wouldn't be any petrol stations, and the way in which all these different, how unmechanized Germany was, because it's not what you expect. Because I have an image of Germany as the home of high end motoring manufacturer,
and the fact BMWs that they were kind of
I thought it was really, really interesting, and obviously. Our huge numbers of listeners who downloaded that episode agreed. So
it did.
You've learnt the error of your ways, and
I have done. So Al Akfar had a very good question. He's generally been of the view that German defeat was largely inevitable for the reasons discussed. However, he does point out that Germany was pretty much able to defeat the Russian Empire in the First World War. What changed was the Soviet Union in 1941 just a much more resilient polity than the Russian Empire in 1917. That is I wish your brother was here, because that is an excellent question.
The Germans in the First World War were not trying to capture St. Petersburg and Moscow and whatever Stalingrad was called then.
But they got, the beginning of 1918 or whenever the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk was, they had a fantastic result as from their point of view, as in they had taken Ukraine, they had taken...
Yeah, but they weren't trying to capture Moscow.
I mean, your brother did say this in the podcast, that it's not clear what Hitler's end game in the Soviet Union is. So at what point has he won and got the result that he wanted?
Riding in triumph through Moscow.
Yes, I suppose so. It's a good example, isn't it, of how that sort of Wagnerian imagination of Hitler's is completely leads him awry, I would say. David Platt. Former the Aston Villa.
Villa,
Bari, Juventus, Sampdoria. Well, anyway, he's appears to be listening to the rest of his history, or perhaps more plausibly somebody else with the same name. And he says, really interesting details in a part of world history I thought I knew so well. But he has an excellent question for your brother. Why does James Holland bellow at the listener like he's speaking to a deaf major across the bar at his local? So, Tom, is this a fair criticism, or do you think unfair?
I think he finds it all so exciting,
that
he just wants to share the news with everyone.
Yes,
I think it conveys his enormous sense of enthusiasm.
I think we have a genre of guest who Willie Dalrymple.
Willie is another, isn't he?
Would be a brilliant man. Put him across the bar at a golf club, and you would still hear his opinions about Afghanistan.
I think both of them are enormous enthusiasts and enormously knowledgeable.
Yeah.
And that they speak with tremendous fluency about often incredibly complicated topics.
Yeah.
And such is their fluency that perhaps, they get impatient with anyone who might interrupt the onward flow.
Dan Snow in the Seven Years War podcast. Dan, yeah. Remember, sort of wound him up and off he went.
Yeah.
Now, I got a lot of grief. I basically said expressly in the previous podcast, do not give me a lot of grief about saying I don't like science.
And that's exactly what you've been given, isn't it?
So Sam the Burgundian Wang sent a list of 10 scientists and inventors who he thinks I need to know about as a penance. And I was curious, Tom, how many of these... So can you tell me who all these people are, what they discovered? Thomas Edison.
Yeah.
What's he? Light bulbs.
Yeah, and all that kind of stuff. I'm not very good on inventors.
Marie Curie.
Yeah, radiation and radioactivity and all that kind of stuff.
You know, David Lammy, the shadow foreign secretary. Mm-hmm. Did you ever see when he was on Celebrity Mastermind?
No.
They said which Marie discovered radiation and died of it, and he said Marie Antoinette.
not the Marie Celeste.
They asked him on the same program. The question was, what was the name of the boy king born to Henry VIII who died when he was 16 or whatever hour? However old he was. And he said, is it Henry the VII? Anyway.
But he's a smart guy, isn't he?
Politics is in grey hands.
But he studied at Harvard and all kinds of things. I mean, I think your mind goes blank.
Maybe. He can't answer Henry the VII to a question about the son of Henry
the VIII. No, but, you know.
All right. Number three on the scientist list, and I raise my eyebrows at this, is Gandalf. Is he? What's that? Is there a scientist called Gandalf? Surely not.
So you're very familiar with wizards.
Yeah, I am.
You know more about wizards than inventors.
I'm very familiar with wizards. If it was Dumbledore, Gandalf,
Merlin.
Yeah, Merlin.
Number four, Charles Darwin.
Yeah.
You must know about Darwin. We're going to do an episode on Darwin.
Leonardo.
Is he really an inventor, though? I mean, he never invented anything.
Yes, he's more. I mean, a man
kind of his helicopters never worked.
He's a man kind of sketching in his bedroom, isn't he, Leonardo?
That paint that he invented to use for the Last Supper, and that's why it's hopeless because it's all just flaked off.
Isaac Newton, top scientist. Surely the winner of the world's greatest scientist. Now, this is one for you. Averroes. Is that Averroes? Yes. Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
How is he different from Avicenna? They're the same man in my mind.
Oh, I can never remember. Yeah.
But they're both involved with
kind of optics and medicine and all that kind of stuff.
Is Averroes, is he Baghdad or is he Al-Andalus?
I can't remember.
Oh, Tom, come on.
I'm being ambushed with this.
Nikola Tesla.
Isn't that... And he invented
the electric
self-driving car.
Yes. Now, there's another man here who I think probably played for Anderlecht in 1982. Anthony van Leeuwenhoek. Do you know him?
It's a microscope.
Really?
Yeah, Dutch Golden Age. Microscope. Yeah, I know that.
I've never seen that name before in my life. And Max Planck. I know there's a Max Planck Institute, but I don't know why. Who's Max Planck?
It's something to do with atoms.
Atoms. Okay, well, I think... For people who say we don't do enough science, I think we put that one to bed.
The rest is science and technology.
Yeah, the rest of science is surely very only hours away from being commissioned.
But I mean, there's lots of science I do like. So I do like Darwin, which we're going to do.
Yeah.
And I do like Galileo. So we do Galileo.
But I think what's interesting to them, as we said before, is that they're gateways into their time as much as anything.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Tom, there's one last thing I wanted to talk about, because on Saturday... I had a day off for the first time in ages because I've just finished my most recent children's
book. Have you? Your Vikings book?
Yeah.
You finished? So congratulations.
I have finished. Thank you.
I haven't finished mine.
You're very close though, aren't you?
No. I've just killed Titus and Domitian is about to succeed.
How many more emperors you got to go through in this?
After Domitian, I've got Nerva, Trajan and Hadrian.
What? You're delivering in about a week, aren't you?
No, I'm delivering in end of July.
Crikey, that's going to be quite...
Yeah, thanks, Dominic. Yeah, go on.
Anyway, so I had the morning off for the first time in ages, and I went for a coffee, and then I was looking at my phone, and I saw something that made me very happy. I love an academic controversy in which everybody comes out really badly. and this was one, because somebody sent us a tweet, didn't they? Have the two of you seen this furore involving the world's medievalists and the Los Angeles Review of Books. So for those people who don't know, well, which I assume is pretty much everybody, the review was of a book called The Bright Ages, which was a new history of the Middle Ages, which had what struck me as a slightly hackneyed thesis, that the Middle Ages were not all mud and torture and vomit, but actually...
They actually occasionally, did things.
Sun shone, tremendous things happened. I mean, that doesn't strike me as enormously...
I mean, it's kind of interesting because it's almost an identical title to The Light Ages.
By Seb Falk.
Seb Falk, who is guest of the show.
But his book was very focused on science, whereas this is a kind of general history of the Middle Ages, saying actually the Middle Ages weren't all bad. Anyway, this person, Mary Rambaran Olm, she submitted a review of this book to the Los Angeles Review of Books. They didn't run the review. She was outraged because they ran a different review instead. And then it all massively kicked off on social media because
it was everyone accusing everyone else of being racist.
And she posted her review of this book online to shame the journal. I read it with enormous pleasure because the review struck me as quite mad. And I probably wouldn't have run it myself because she talks to give listeners some sort of sense. The review basically says the book is
it's a white supremacist tome.
Well, it wasn't. Is it white supremacist?
And it's footnotes, so it has no footnotes, and that's white supremacist.
Well, that's a sign of white male privilege to have no footnotes.
Yes,
there was a lot of stuff like this.
But you have footnotes, so you pass that test.
Well, I have endnotes. I don't know. Is that white male privilege?
I think endnotes are all right. I think the thing that for neutral observers that's quite entertaining about the whole thing is that the two, well, certainly one of the authors is he's a tremendous he's tremendously ready to accuse other historians of white supremacy and all kinds of stuff.
Am I not right in thinking that it's one of the authors in his sights is my co-presenter on The Rest Is History?
Well, yeah, so I did get kind of dragged into this mulch machine because the woman who wrote this review was also very prominent in arguing that the phrase Anglo-Saxon was racist.
Mary Rambrown Olm. Yes, she resigned, didn't she, from the Association of Anglo-Saxon Studies or whatever.
And that therefore anyone who uses the word Anglo-Saxon is a white supremacist. Since I just finished a book on the Rex Anglo-Saxonum, who was Athelstan, I kind of slightly resented the implication that he literally used this phrase, the implication that for me to say this, that I was being a white supremacist, I found that annoying. And so I put out an intemperate tweet about it.
I bet it wasn't that intemperate, Tom. You're never intemperate. Wouldn't have been intemperate by my standards, I imagine.
It wouldn't have been as intemperate as yours, but I think it was, by my standards, it was pretty intemperate. And so I it was a kind of classic Twitter thing where all kinds of mad American professors piled in.
Yeah.
And what I objected to about it was we've said things that I hate, kind of American cultural imperialism. It was the assumption that just because it may, the phrase Anglo-Saxon may have a particular connotation in the United States, therefore this should delegitimize all the various other uses that the phrase Anglo-Saxon has. And, not just in Britain, where it has a very clear sense. I mean, everyone knows who the Anglo-Saxons are. It's a distinctive period of history. It would be insane to get rid of it just because it has a different connotation in America.
Because no one uses that. For American listeners, nobody in Britain uses the phrase Anglo-Saxon really to mean anything but
the
period pre 1066.
And what this woman was arguing was that instead people should use the phrase Early English, not recognizing that actually that is a much more loaded term in the context of Britain, where we have the English Defence League, which is a kind of hard right pressure group. We don't call it the Anglo-Saxon Defence League. And they simply couldn't care about that. They couldn't care about the nuances or the resonances within Britain. And also, of course, in France or Germany, the word Anglo-Saxon has, again, a completely different meaning. So that's why
Tom, am I right in thinking that if you were Northumbrian in the 9th century or something, the word English, let's say, might have been, I don't know, more contested, more fluid, more...
Well, it doesn't really exist.
Yeah, exactly. As far as we can,
to say early English is itself anachronistic.
Yeah.
So it seemed insane to me. What it seems at issue in this whole imbroglio is both sides are looking at the Middle Ages through the prism of contemporary American cultural politics. And that seems to me profoundly... that's demented. Not the way that you should be doing history.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. Actually,
I mean, the idea of whiteness is whatever your views of it, it's a very 21st century American concern. It makes no sense to back project that onto medieval Europe, where the idea of whiteness did not exist.
This review kicked off, this review that didn't get run in the Los Angeles Review of Books. It kicked off with a huge discussion of Frantz Fanon's view of whiteness. Mm-hmm. Never explained why this was applicable to 12th century, France or whatever. And I think it's really interesting how these debates within American academia are actually completely imprisoned, aren't they? Within the straitjacket.
Well, Dominic, what I'm going to say now is another thing that the reviewer was objecting to was the Christocentrism.
Of the
perspective saying,
God almighty, they wouldn't like Dominion.
No, absolutely not. But of course, it's an entirely Christian take. The last shall be first and the first shall be last. The whole premise is founded on the idea that those who have been historically disadvantaged should be raised up, which would only make sense in a culture that is absolutely saturated in Christian assumptions. So in every way, it seemed to me very, very mad. And historically, historically shoddy, I thought.
Everybody in this debate, which is absolutely typical of American academic cultural debates, everybody was accusing everybody else of being insufficiently progressive, weren't they? So that they're all using the same vocabulary to attack one another. You're a white supremacist. No, you are. That kind of this. Yeah. And nobody ever questions the terminology or the parameters of the debate or...
To plough an obvious furrow, it's about heresy hunting, and it's an argument over who's the inquisitor and who's the heretic.
Yeah,
you know, which in the context of a book about medieval history has a certain irony.
To take you back, Tom, just for a second, to a previous podcast that we did. So I think our fifth or sixth podcast. How much do you think that heresy hunting, and I agree with you, it is heresy hunting, and it's something that I don't think existed when we were, you know, in our teens or 20s or something. There's any parallel for that in the kind of 80s or 90s or something. But how much do you think that's been generated by social media?
I think it's amplified it, but I think it's expressive of broader trends, you know, that certainly I have talked about quite a lot about it's about the aftershocks of the 60s and the way that the 60s have affected a mutation within the fabric of let's call it Christian thought.
Yeah.
And uncoupled it from Christian theology and Christian devotional practice. And so it's now taking on all kinds of strange new forms, mm-hmm. rather like in, you know, 1650s or something, that or the Anabaptists in the early years of the Reformation. But once the institutional frameworks have gone, then people rush around all over the place, kind of trying out new ways of seeing the world. And often there's a kind of a sense of a virtue spiral that you have to, you have to become ever more strident in your claims for kind of moral superiority, because that becomes a source of your legitimacy. So I think it's that. I think that social media has amplified that process, but I think the process was already well in train. I mean, it has been ever since the 60s.
But also, Tom, that extraordinary sort of cultural revolution style moment, to pick up on another of our previous podcasts, where I think generally only people in America do this, though sometimes people in Britain, if they're very progressive and very active on social media, they'll do the full recantation and the self-denunciation and the self-flagellation. And so you had this with one of the people. So one of the people who had turned down this review from the Los Angeles
Sarah Bond, who's
a classicist.
She's a great classicist, and she's done a lot of good on social media.
She first explained why they hadn't run this review. She said it wasn't appropriate, blah, 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 blah. And then a sort of day later, she posted this huge message saying, I was totally wrong. I need to do more. I need to educate myself. I need to blah, 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 blah. And then she deleted her account. And it's just such a weird thing, that, isn't it? I mean, I can't imagine.
Again,
I'm temperamentally just a sinner, but I can't imagine
that's
ever doing.
That's what the Inquisition is all about. I mean, the Inquisition don't want to burn you necessarily. They want to see you recant and redeem your soul.
But it's terrible. Well, we're just getting into, we're now talking about people shouting golf clubs. We've degenerated into golf club pedantry, but I think maybe pedantry is the wrong word, just golf club pontification. But I think it's terrible, that sort of pressure that is put upon people to publicly recant on what are clearly their deeply held, you know, that you reject a review for a good reason.
That is why, you know, that certain episodes in the past at certain periods of cultural history can seem absolutely insane. And I would say that what's at stake, say, in medieval Europe, mm-hmm. with heresy and with the Inquisition, it just seems completely bizarre. I mean, it's the stuff of Monty Python sketches and jokes, and nobody can take it remotely seriously. But now I think we can see much more clearly how these kind of issues would absolutely be a matter of life and death for people, and how people's, you know, deeper sense of their themselves, their souls, their everything that they believe might be at stake. And I think that therefore, in a way, it provides a kind of a glass through which we can see aspects of the medieval past more clearly. That's not to say that the parallels are exact, but I think that history is like kind of kaleidoscope. You turn it, you know, as things change and turn, so your understanding of the past turns as well.
I agree. So basically, the lesson is that everybody should write for, or at the very least, read the Daily Mail, and then we'd be
Dominion.
World.
I think Dominion is the answer there. Could I? We should finish, because I've got to rush off. But just one last thing, which is, Dominic, that you have very generously given up your time to come and in 2 weeks' time.
Oh, yeah. I know, I'm looking. I know,
the look of panic on your face. we're going
That's
to,
right.
This is the whole history of the world in 1 hour, which we're doing for charity at St. Martin in the Fields. That's in 2 weeks' time. There are very few tickets left for the gala dinner but there are some still left.
And gala dinner, Tom, not even just a dinner.
Yeah, you can sit with Dominic and he can give you his views on the world.
We can talk about science.
Yeah, talk about science. You can talk about whatever you like. And if you fancy that, please do email info@tomhollandbenefit2021.com. info@tomhollandbenefit2021.com.
Yeah.
And if you'd like to sign up to the live stream, so all the tickets for the actual venue have gone, but if you'd like to sign up for the live stream, details to events section of my website, which is tomhollandbenefit2021.com/events. tomhollandbenefit2021.com/events.
Jolly good. Well, we hope to see as many people as possible there. It's a very good cause, and it'll make Tom look incredibly philanthropic.
It'll make me look noble and holy.
Exactly, which is how he should.
That's what it's all about.
So, Tom, you've got to run. You've got to go somewhere, you said.
Yeah, I've got to go and talk about cricket.
Oh.
I'm doing a panel on cricket with Sebastian Folkes.
Oh, that's
the
nice.
Glamour.
Yeah, you lead a very exciting
the glamour.
Right. We'll see you all next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.